Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
In his wonderful book, 32 Words for Field, Monken McGann devotes a chapter to belief in fairies and spirit creatures, and suggests there are psychological benefits to acknowledging another layer of existence alongside the here and now. My mother sprang to mind. That there was an open channel of communication to saints through prayer and to spirits through pishogues was undoubtedly a comfort to her. But for her, as for many of us, the dividing line between religion and superstition was a bit blurry. She regularly bribed St. Anthony with offers of money in return for help in locating misplaced keys or gloves. As the fee rose and fell in proportion to the value of the missing item, St. Anthony came to resemble one of those lucky Hollywood actors whose contract automatically includes a percentage of the profits. Although she never purchased a statue of the Child of Prague because she was unconvinced by claims he could influence the weather, she nevertheless felt it prudent, in the run-up to my sister's January wedding, to borrow one and place it under the hedge in the back garden to ward off rain. When the big day dawned with a mixture of snow and sunshine, she felt the most the Child of Prague deserved was a B for effort. My mother worked for many years as a general nurse, theatre sister and midwife. Despite her medical training, when my brother was afflicted by an outbreak of warts of biblical proportions on his left hand, she chose to ignore conventional medicine and opted instead for a folk cure from her native Armagh. This involved spitting on a small piece of beef, which was then rubbed on the warts, and buried in the garden at midnight, to the accompaniment of prayers and imprecations. It worked. Within only 2 or perhaps 3 years, my brother was declared wart-free. I'm happy to report he remains wart-free to this day. The school's collection is a treasure trove of such beliefs, gathered by schoolchildren from all parts of the country in the late 1930s. A child in Inishnee, near Roundstone in Connemara, writes that a cure for whooping cough is to ask a man riding a white horse for advice and to follow whatever instructions he gives. Arthritis can be eased by drinking water from the three wells nearest your house. Toothache can be cured forever, she assures us, by placing a frog in one's mouth for a few minutes. Most of us think of these superstitions as relics of a simpler age, one when it was easier to believe in miracles and cures and healing wells, but which vanished once the electric light and the television were switched on all across Ireland. Yet it's not that long ago that a friend of mine, also in Inishnee, showed me that belief in liminal forces was alive and well. Sean had wanted to clear a piece of the shoreline to create a more convenient spot to moor his new curragh. This was a big job. It necessitated manhandling stones and boulders out of the way. Larger rocks were split by means of the age-old method of lighting turf fires on them and then rapidly cooling them with seawater. A day or two into the work, he was approached by an older neighbour who asked him what he was at. When Sean explained, the neighbour looked at him witheringly and said, "There are better men than you, Sean, who lived here and who never moved those stones. You won't have a day's luck." He turned on his heel and walked away. Sean was rattled. He felt as if his neighbour had summoned agents of retribution, perhaps divine, perhaps the Dhini Maha, to put manners on him. In his eagerness for a new mooring place, it had never occurred to him that by moving a few rocks that had lain untouched for countless generations, he was not just disturbing the shoreline, he had dared to disturb the universe. I met him a few weeks later And he told me that, sure enough, the bad luck had started. He held up a homemade walking stick. He'd been out gathering sheep on the hill at the back of Kinraver, and for the first time in his life had slipped and twisted his ankle. Not only that, one of his calves had just fallen sick. That was two pieces of bad luck. There would be three, he said. A third thing was on the way. I should never have gone near the shore, he said. I commiserated with him and made vague comforting sounds to the effect that he shouldn't worry about that kind of stuff. They were just accidents. No accidents, no accidents, he said ruefully. The next day, when I dropped in, his spirits seemed to have lifted a little. Watch this now, he said. He produced a box of matches. I'm going to break the spell. He took a match from the box, held it up in front of me, and very deliberately snapped it in two. This simple remedy seemed to reassure him. And it reassured him so much that it also reassured me. And I thought, it wouldn't kill me to place some faith in miracles and cures and healing wells.
Snow and winter do not just relate to the season, but to two remarkable and powerful women in fashion, Carmel Snow and Anna Wintour. The latter often referred to as Anna Nuclear Wintour for her formidable fraudeur. Snow was from Dalkey. She was white before she was Snow, and for more than 20 years was as feared and revered as Wintour is today. In her time as editor-in-chief of Harper's Bazaar in America, Snow brought innovation and style to its fashion, fiction, reportage and photography. Her mantra was to produce a magazine for well-dressed women with well-dressed minds. And she did that from the early 1930s to the mid-1950s. Slight and always impeccably dressed, mostly in Balenciaga, who was a close friend, this extraordinary Irish woman nurtured the careers of many who became household names, among them the great photographers Richard Avedon and Edward Steichen, the fashion columnist Diana Vreeland, who became even more famous than Snow, Truman Capote, Andy Warhol, Lauren Bacall, Cartier-Bresson, Carson McCullers, and our own Maeve Brennan. Snow was the first to spot the talent of a young illustrator called Christian Dior and is credited with calling his sensational Paris debut in 1947 the new look. The third daughter of Peter and Annie White, she was born on the 27th of August 1887 in their home, St. Justin's in Dalkey, and called after Our Lady of Mount Carmel. Her father, who worked for the Irish Woolen Manufacturing and Export Company in Dublin, was a Parnellite nationalist, and his landlord in Dalkey was the Irish Republican activist Michael Davitt. A key figure in the revival of a once thriving industry, White helped to set up the Irish Village at the Chicago World Fair promoting Irish craft in the US for the first time. After his sudden death, his widow Annie, with their six children, took over his role, and the family eventually moved to live in New York, where Annie opened a shop selling Irish goods. Carmel and her sister would accompany their mother to the Paris fashion shows, where they were assigned to memorise the fashions. Carmel the top part, her sister the bottom, so that they could be copied in the shop. She learned to make quick, accurate and imaginative decisions, a skill that remained throughout her life. Her career was launched in 1921 when she was hired by the publisher Condé Nast and became an assistant fashion editor at Vogue. 2 years later, she was hiring her own assistants, supervising fashion shoots, choosing models and photographers, and attending the fashion shows in Paris for 3 weeks at a time. She also met and married an attorney, George Palin Snow, then in his 40s, from an old New York family, and soon afterwards produced the first of their three daughters. At the magazine, Carmel's influence was seen in its more modern approach to fashion and layouts. The birth of her second child coincided with the next big step in her life when she was offered the job of fashion editor at Harper's Bazaar, a decision that branded her as a traitor by Vogue, but offered her the challenge she so badly wanted. She went on to become its editor and make it the most admired magazine of the century, lively and bursting with ideas. In her 40s, adored and feared, she counted many of the most famous artists and writers of the 20th century as her friends and contributors to the magazine, among them Jean Cocteau, Nancy Mitford, W.H. Auden and Cecil Beaton. Alert to culture in its various forms, she increased the readership to over 190,000, outshining Vogue on all its terms. She never forgot her Irish background and made a return trip to Ireland in the mid-1930s to introduce her daughters to their Irish relatives. In 1953, on a celebrated trip home, she brought a group of US fashion journalists to a fashion show in Dunsany Castle. Richard Avedon's photographs of Sybil Connolly's collection ran in Bazaar that October. Connolly's subsequent trip to the US was a triumph for the Irish designer. Snow continued to rule the roost at Harper's, but as commercial pressures mounted and increasingly business considerations trumped aesthetic ones, she eventually withdrew, remaining chair of the board, but handing over the reins to her niece, Nancy White. It was then, persuaded by John Houston, that she decided to retire to Ireland and, without even telling her husband, purchased an 18th-century house, Rossivera, near Newport, County Mayo, for £9,000 from Sir Owen O'Malley and his wife Mary, a novelist. The reality, however, of life on the Irish coast proved more daunting and lonely than expected. And as the adventure went sour, the house was eventually sold to Walter Curley, the US ambassador to Ireland and France. It still remains in the Curley family. Back in Manhattan, Snow set about writing a memoir, but on the 7th of May 1961, after a family birthday party, she died of a sudden heart attack in her sleep and was buried in Long Island. Richard Avedon had the last word. She understood that fashion was much more than a hemline. She understood that it existed in fiction, travel, movies, theatre, with influences coming from everywhere. She brought modernity to the things she touched and the life she lived. She wasn't just an editor. She was the only editor.
My grandfather, Henry Joe, was a small farmer in the west of Ireland, but at heart and in his own mind, he was an inventor at the cutting edge of advanced physics. In his workshop, along with the pitchforks, shovels, awls and the wax end thread used to mend the tackle for his donkey and cart, he owned a slide rule for making scale drawings and a yard-long wooden ruler that measured inches in big black numerals and unfolded on brass hinges to convert abstract ideas into experimental prototypes. He was convinced that humankind had not truly grasped the full potential of the interlinked forces of motion, magnetism and electricity. And thus, as the jobs piled up on the farm, He plotted the motion of ball-bearing races and tracked the movements of flywheels, magnets, and propellers to crack the problem of perpetual motion. A machine or a mechanism that would work indefinitely without receiving new energy. I was reminded of Henry Joe at a stage adaptation of the life of Jonathan Swift in the Factory Theatre in Sligo, when the scene shifts to Gulliver's Travels and the flying island of Laputa, where its inhabitants use a special lodestone to manoeuvre the island through the air, having mastered the power of magnetic levitation. It dawned on me that Henry Joe must have read Swift when he got to his feet in the pub one evening, a little the worse for drink, it should be said, during the early years of the Apollo space missions, and boasted, "Give me 4 bicycle wheels and a big enough magnet and I'll land a man on the moon." The one essential chore he meticulously embraced was this trip to collect his and my grandmother's pensions every Friday, along with the groceries, after which he took a drink. First, he had to round up the donkey, a task that often set Henry Joe himself in motion, around the field, a bridle in his hand, in pursuit of the work-shy beast. After fitting the tackle, the loading of the cart began, with a bundle of hay and a bucket of water to re-energise his transport, a flour bag stuffed with straw for his seat, plus the shopping bags and straps used to secure them against the G-forces when he said "giddy up" and the donkey broke into a trot. As painstaking as these preparations might seem, they were nothing compared to the writing of the shopping list. First, his penknife had to be sharpened on an emery stone, his reading glasses polished, and the pencil used to draw his blueprints freshly pointed. Finally, he declared himself ready to have the shopping list dictated to him by my grandmother, who sat waiting in her chair beside the fire, her thumbs impatiently spinning like twin propellers at a speed greater than anything Grandad had yet to contrive in his workshop. In the pub, where the Arigna coal miners gathered to wash down the dust after work, they were happy to stand Henry Joe a drink while he regaled them with his latest brain teaser. A stable owner dies and leaves 3 sons 17 horses. The will stipulates the oldest son gets half the horses, the second son 1/3 of the horses, and the third son 1/9. But the half of 17 is 8.5, and you can't have half a horse. "You could have a half share in a horse," a coal miner suggested. "Did I say anything about shares?" Henry Joe ruled the suggestion out of order. "Could they not sell the horses and divide the money?" another coal miner asked, deliberately to get a rise out of Grandad. "Man dear, who said anything about selling horses?" The dafter the answers offered, the more indignant Henry Joe grew, until his audience got the result they wanted all along, when he threw his hat onto the floor in exasperation at the ignorance marshalled against him, never asking himself what mark of intelligence it was to be quizzing coal miners only looking for entertainment after a hard day's work. When it was time to go home, Henry Joe cheerfully enlightened his audience by introducing a borrowed horse. The borrowed horse is added to the 17, bringing the total to 18 horses. The first son leads away 9 horses, the half of 18. The second son takes away 6 horses, a third of 18, and the third son gets 2 horses, his 9th share. 9 plus 6 plus 2 equals 17. And the borrowed horse goes back to the owner. Henry Joe then settled his cap back on his head, after which he mounted his donkey and cart. The reins held lightly between his fingers, his head in the clouds, his mind turned again to magnetic fields more than farm chores.
Urbi et Orbi. It was Christmas, or maybe Easter, when the national broadcaster beamed Giovanni Montini into our kitchen. We knelt with our mother for his blessing in front of the new television. Our father stilled the rolling of the screen while we waited, the red linoleum soft under our knees, the cold of the old floor blocked by cork underlay, praying for the static snow to settle, the Vatican balcony to appear, and the third pontiff of my life so far to raise his hand and chant the holy words. Father marvelled that a blessing could travel from Rome to Balask on waves of electricity. We shushed him and held our plastic rosaries aloft, beads missing, small crucifixes chewed, our faith firm in the power of flickering images, greedy for the magic rays from a Pope's right hand.
I have a sheepskin coat from years ago, tan collar, warm lining, fur-style collar, that I had worn over several winters and then put away. Thankfully, I didn't give it away, as I have done with so many other pieces of clothing. I wore the coat again recently, and a girl said to me, "Oh, I love your coat. Is it vintage?" I laughed and said, "It's me that is vintage." And then I wondered, antique or vintage, what is the difference? And where do I fit on the timeline? When I checked, antique is something from before the 1920s. True vintage is 50 years ago. Vintage is 20 years ago. And retro is a garment imitating vintage style. So, the clothes my grandmother wore as a girl are antique. My mother's are true vintage. And I flow from true vintage to vintage, depending on the clothing. There are times when I see an item of clothing in a shop, like a skinny ribbed turtleneck jumper, and it makes me smile. I wore that type of jumper in the 70s. I never would have thought that the same clothes would come back in style. How clothes that are modern and then became old-fashioned would become up-to-date again. We perceived then how we would look after 2001, the Space Odyssey year. Shows like Lost in Space or Star Trek gave the impression that we would be in mercury-coated clothes by now. Looking back, I remember the first time I saw a girl wearing wide bell-bottom trousers with a floral pattern. We were in Central Park, New York, in the 60s. And when I pointed the girl out to my mother, she rolled her eyes and said, "Oh, a hippie." I watched the girl as she walked through the park, the way the end of the bell bottoms flapped as she moved. It was the age of Aquarius, a time of rising protest against the Vietnam War. The girl's wide bell bottoms stood out to me in a city of men in suits. For that moment in time, the hippie movement and their clothes were a sign of a peaceful revolution. And there were quiet braveries in the wearing of certain clothing here as well. When I look back at photographs of my mother and aunts from those years, they look so cool, so stylish. In a time when women were still being churched, the first woman in a small town who walked up the aisle and into a pew while wearing a miniskirt showed courage. After a while, many were wearing miniskirts, so there would have been protection in their numbers. But that first woman would have started others chattering, would have risked being called mutton dressed as lamb. Or the first woman who landed at the school gates to collect her children while wearing trousers. The first woman to turn up at a dinner dance wearing a trouser suit or hot pants. Or the immigrants that landed home on vacation wearing the newest styles, like my aunt, as she walked up the town in a brightly patterned dress and wearing sunglasses, would have raised a few eyebrows and comments, "Ah, the returned Yank." Young men also took steps in style braveries, like the first Teddy boys landing home from London to rural Ireland. Are those boys the first who even slightly followed the glam rock flamboyance of Bowie, Sweet, or Freddie Mercury and wore the gear to local dance halls? And the first who wore Bay City roller trousers and shirts into their secondary schools? Those who were marched home again to change or else be placed into detention. Their bravery and risking being bullied for standing out. All those clothes are vintage now and can be worn with ease. If I had held on to my going away suit from 1980, it would be wearable now for someone. The skirt and jacket and black and white houndstooth check. But is that idea of a going away suit that is true vintage? The way the security guard at Belfast Airport's departure gate handed me a form to fill out and she said, "Don't forget to use your new name." I asked her how she knew and she laughed. "I can spot newlyweds a mile off." And she looked at my new suit, shoes and handbag. So many styles that once were new trends are now moving anti-clockwise through time. Miami Vice suits, Starsky cardigans, Dynasty and Dallas shoulder padded jackets might all come back again. Who knew in the 70s, 80s or even the 90s that we could be modern then and be stylish all over again in the same type of clothes? When it comes to fashion, the future can be the past and still bring joy.
Wake up, you sleepy head. Put on some clothes, shake up your bed. Put another log on the fire for me. I made some breakfast and coffee. Look out my window, what do I see? Crackin'.
This poem has the structure and metre of a Shakespearean sonnet, but none of the panache. It is simply a defence of my failure to cultivate my tiny garden with any degree of flair or finesse, and an apology to that small patch of living ground for my neglectful stewardship. It's called Winter Garden. That I neglect my garden is a lie. Abandoned it is closer to the truth. my free times for my little girl and boy, reserved for them the last blush of my youth, and not some stupid plant with thorny stalks who'll need fine-tuned degrees of sun and rain. We'll dwell among the nettles and the docks while flowers bloom and die and bloom again. They don't need me to tell them how to be. They know to drink the rain and face the sun. They know that in my garden they are free. They won't be pruned or plucked or cut for fun. What joy can be wrung from a dead bouquet? For fleeting pleasure, life is torn from clay.
On this morning's programme, we heard Miracles and Cures and Healing Wells by Conall Hamill. Then Snow White by Deirdre McQuillan. That was followed by The Great Inventor by Brian Leyden. Then a poem by A.M. Cousins, Urbi et Orbi. Then we heard Wearing Vintage by Denise Blake. And finally, Winter Garden, a poem by Donal Ryan. The music this morning, we had The King of the Fairies by Sean Maguire on fiddle. Then Moon River by Henry Mancini and his orchestra. Perpetuum Mobile by Penguin Cafe Orchestra. And then there was Schumann's Kindersensen, the fourth movement, played on piano by Angela Hewitt. And finally, David Bowie and Oh, You Pretty Things. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.